The reading is taken from Psalms 19, page 552. The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language. Where their voices is not heard, their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens he has pitched a tent for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from its pavilion, like a champion rejoining his run course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple.
The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure and altogether righteous. They are much more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the comb. By them is your servant warned. In keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then will I be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer.
Right, well, thank you for giving me the privilege of speaking to this title. You've got sheets in front of you, so do be making use of those. Do be jotting down questions as we go. I'm up for any questions. We'll have a time of questions later. I'll speak for about half an hour, but I'm sure we'll need to be carrying on with lots of questions, so I'll be over there at the end. So do be writing those questions down and getting ready to think about things more deeply. Well, I hope amongst our number that those who would describe ourselves as atheists or agnostics, great to have you here. Thank you for coming. I hope you'll enjoy another theist trying to persuade you otherwise. I hope we'll enjoy understanding a bit more about the whole topic of Darwin, Dawkins and God. Some of us may be convinced theists, but not Christians. Do consider with me whether the God of the Bible is giving us a real picture of the world we experience around us. But many think that the choice we face is between an unrealistic God of the gaps, the idea that God is only seen really in the things that we don't understand, the mystical, or the reality of nature read in tooth and claw. Many think that the choice that we face is between a sort of sentimental God, a kind of God as a comfort blanket, as Dawkins would put it, and nature that appears to be without purpose, without justice, without morality. Well, this evening, I hope you'll see that I'm not arguing for a God of the gaps, but a God of the gasp, or depending where you're from. I'm a bit schizophrenic on this one, you see, because my dad was Northern Mancunian, so it's either gasp or gasp, depending on where you're from. So I'm not arguing for a God of the gaps, but a God of the gasp. And I'm not arguing for God from design, but from chaos. Now, I'm just learning how to use this thing, so if I get the wrong slide, do let me know, won't you? We should have a quote from Richard Dawkins there, in debate with John Lennox, a fellow Oxford lecturer. And this was Dawkins in a debate a couple of years ago. I think that when you consider the beauty of the world, and you wonder how it came to be, what it is, you are naturally overwhelmed with a feeling of awe, a feeling of admiration, and you almost feel a desire to worship something. I feel this, says Dawkins. I recognize that other scientists, such as Carl Sagan, feel this. Einstein felt it. We all of us share a kind of religious reverence for the beauties of the universe, for the complexity of life, for the sheer magnitude of the cosmos, the clear magnitude of geological time. And it's tempting to translate that feeling of awe and worship into a desire to worship a particular thing, a particular person. Now, of course, Dawkins doesn't give in to that particular temptation. He argues that science has liberated us from the superstition of belief in God. But I don't think we can write off this experience quite so easily. I think that is to suppress something we actually experience, something that is real, not illusory. So what I want to examine first is, can science and can scientists deny this experience quite so easily, and therefore deny the God that we're tempted to worship? Can science support atheism? You see, science carries great weight, doesn't it? Great authority. If a scientist says it, we're inclined to believe it more than maybe an artist. So it's important to understand what science can say, what scientists can say, and what they cannot. If I were to ask directions from one of you, I'd want to know that you had a local knowledge, that you weren't a tourist. It would not work, would it, if I asked somebody who was just visiting where everything was? No, they need to have local knowledge. Is a scientist and has science a local knowledge of this whole area we're considering, the existence of God? Well, how might we define science? There we have one definition, which I think is a pretty good one. An inductive, empirical, quantitative, mechanistic observation of nature. It's inductive. It works from particular instances of things to the general, to establish general laws. It's empirical. A scientist only deals in that which can be observed or sensed by a variety of instruments from which quantitative measurements can be made. And science is mechanistic. Is interested in the mechanisms of how things work. Oh, I need to go back one. This is Erwin Schrödinger. Many of you will have come across him. The scientific picture of the world around me is very deficient, he says. And a little later on he says, it knows nothing of beauty and ugly, good or bad, God or eternity. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, but the answers are often so silly that we're not inclined to take them seriously. But unfortunately, people do. He goes on. Or take Stephen Jay Gould, an evolutionary biologist, an atheist who would have no sort of theological axe to grind. He says this, science simply cannot, by its legitimate methods, adjudicate the issue of God's possible superintendence of nature. We neither affirm nor deny it. We simply can't comment on it as scientists. Now, Einstein becomes a bit of a football in the whole debate, doesn't he? But it's worth getting the record straight. He didn't see that atheism was a logical follow-on from science. He said, I'm not an atheist, and I don't think I can call myself a pantheist. We're in the position of a little child entering a huge library of books in many languages. The child knows someone must have written these books. It does not know how. Now, he's not saying that he believes in a personal God, but he is saying that when he looks out on the universe, there's intelligence behind it. He was no Christian, but neither was he any atheist. And then Darwin is categoric. It seems to be absurd to doubt that a man may be an ardent theist, somebody who believes in God, and an evolutionist. In my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God. And we can be fairly confident that that was his position. It was a letter written 3 days before he died, in a private situation. He wasn't having the sort of public view in mind. Now, if this is true, it means that science cannot support atheism. It would be irrational to exclude something before you start and then claim that you've disproved it. If you're saying science just has nothing to say on the question of God a priori before you've even started, you can't then at the end of science say, therefore God does not exist. Science simply cannot comment. But we may say, but why appeal to any explanation, therefore? You know, the God hypothesis. Any other explanation? Why not just say, well, science deals in reality? Why believe something that is just spurious, akin to a spaghetti monster, or a teapot circling the earth, to use a couple of examples that Dawkins uses? Well, again, even science itself can answer that question. See, even in science, there is the belief that there are levels of explanation. Quantum theory cannot be used or applied to understand how a rainforest works. Now, we're not thereby denying quantum theory. We're just saying there is another level of knowledge, a different way of investigating. Nature is discontinuous. Some scientific theories do not apply at all to certain areas of knowledge. There are areas of knowledge within science that are real, not just products of the way that we think. Or take history. Could we scientifically investigate what happened in the Spanish Armada? I guess we all know roughly what happened in the Spanish Armada from school. But could we do an experiment to find out? Could we apply Occam's razor, which is the idea that it must be the simplest explanation? No. History is an area of knowledge which is empirical. It's based on sensory data. People who were there, they saw what happened. But we can't say it's scientific in the sense that we've defined it. Empirical, yes. Scientific, no. It's a category, confusion, to believe that science can tell us everything and all knowledge will one day be able to be explained by scientific means. We can say, yes, let's believe those things that our senses tell us. Let's believe those things that we experience. But that does open up the possibility of knowledge that is outside science. So what are these two circles about? Well, science has a realm of knowledge which is not total. We've just seen history is an area of knowledge. What about economics? What about musical knowledge, artistic knowledge? Maybe knowledge about God lies outside science. And even the history of science tells us that science has points where it thinks it knows pretty much everything. But often that's just before it finds out, oh, no, we missed something. And a whole new area of knowledge is discovered. There's a revolution in scientific thinking. So Thomas Kuhn, who's pictured there, has observed how science progresses, and it seems to go in these revolutions. Just when scientists think they know everything, they find that there's a paradigm shift. Some of the outliers and the anomalies that they were ignoring are actually the key to the refinement of a theory. So for these reasons, it would be foolish to believe that science can tell us everything, that science is in some way omniscient, or that one day science will be able to tell us everything. Because even within science, we see that there is discontinuity, there are levels. Now, what's the cash value of this? What does this mean? Well, it means that if a scientist says, as I think we would agree Dawkins would say, I am an atheist because of my science, it doesn't follow. Science cannot establish atheism. It cannot establish theism. And yet, maybe if you're somebody who's a Christian, it's easy to get threatened by such a claim, isn't it? Or somebody who may say, well, I am an atheist or I am an agnostic because I believe in scientific knowledge. Is it possible that you're putting too much weight in science? You know, what if God does not want to be known by science? You see, what if I decided, we're chatting over tea afterwards, and I said, look, I'd really like to get to know you better. It'd be great to find out more about you. Could you give me a hair sample and a swab from your cheek? Would that encourage you in the relationship? What if God is no less wise? What if he doesn't want to be investigated? Because that would make him some kind of object under our investigation. What if he is a person who reacts and relates to us in the way that we understand in our own personal histories, in the history of the world? What if he is not a passive object that can be investigated, but a person, the great I am? And what if he wants to be encountered by everybody and not just the people in white coats? You know, what if he wants to be encountered by a mentally disabled child and is able to be encountered by a mentally disabled child? Not just scientists. But why consider the biblical God rather than just any old God? Well, we had it read a little earlier on. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Do you ever gasp at what you encounter in nature. Does it ever take your breath away? Or can you truthfully say, no, I've never ever experienced anything like that? Do we have to deny the experience that we all seem to share, even the most atheistic of scientists, that we're led to awe and reverence? There's something that comes through nature to us which speaks of another place, another person. Why do we have to explain it away? So science cannot support atheism. Now, I think I'm getting slightly out of kilter here. There we go. On to the next point. Is evolution scientific? We've seen that science maybe cannot explain everything. Now, here I want to distinguish clearly between two words that I'm going to use, evolution and evolutionism. I guess for some of us here, we're very familiar with the theory of evolution. For other of us, this may be new. Evolution is the scientific theory first proposed by Charles Darwin about 150 years ago and developed in what's called the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, so the whole idea of genetics supporting. Evolutionism, I would say, is an ideology, a fusion of evolutionary theory and atheistic beliefs that gives the appearance of scientific credibility. But let's just get clear what evolution is, because I chat to a lot of folk who would describe themselves as atheists or agnostics, and evolution isn't something they yet completely understand. Overproduction of offspring, which leads to competition. You see this whenever you go fishing. There's lots of little fry down there. And if they're salmon fry, you know that for every 100, maybe half or one or half salmon are going to make it back into the river. There's a competition. There's an overproduction of offspring competition. And then that leads to the survival of the fittest. I'm sure you can... Everybody come across the peppered moth in school days? Only those fit, adapted for the environment, will survive. But over long time scales and the process of particulate inheritance passing genes on to the next generation, ultimately all of life can be explained. See, the genius of Darwin was to predict particulate inheritance, later proven by Gregor Mendel, now giving rise to the science of genetics. So there he is, Gregor Mendel, who did a little experiment with some pea plants to show how inheritance works in particles. Now we know that that's genes. So that's the theory of evolution. It's not progressive. It doesn't mean that there's advance. That's all it is. And a couple of myths just to pop before we continue. See, one of the myths is that Christians, that Bible-believing Christians, rejected the theory of evolution. But actually, that isn't the case. There is an enduring mythology that after 1859, evolution faced a concerted campaign of opposition from the church. Nothing could be further from the truth. Virtually every American Protestant zoologist and botanist accepted some form of evolution by the 1870s. So we need to get rid of that kind of idea, that somehow those who took the Bible seriously rejected evolution. It's interesting, actually, that one of the earliest fundamentalists, a guy called B.B. Warfield, described himself as a Darwinist of the purest water. He took the Bible very, very seriously, but that didn't necessarily mean that he rejected every aspect of Darwin's theory. So who was it that had problems with Darwin's theory? Well, Darwin writes about this in his book, The Origin of Species. It was the scientists who had a problem with his theory. The distinctiveness of specific forms and their not being blended together by innumerable transitional links is a very obvious difficulty. The paleontologists of the day had difficulties with Darwin's theory. And the questions still remain. Stephen Jay Gould, as we've already seen, an atheist paleontologist, had difficulties with some aspects of Darwin's theory. Not evolution per se, but the fact that it all happens very gradually. He points to the fossil record as a record of history. As we've seen, history is something you can't repeat. It happens in a particular way. You can't necessarily access or explain history according to science. Now, without going into too much detail, basically, if you're a dinosaur, It doesn't really matter how well adapted you are at surviving if an asteroid lands on your head. In other words, the theory of evolution, as propounded by Darwin, and being very well adapted to particular survival, does not matter if events happen over long timescales, and that could be more important. So that was Stephen Jay Gould's point. Again, the scientists are divided on this, which is perhaps not known outside of evolutionary biology. George Gaylord Simpson, one of the authorities of the 20th century in paleontology, again an atheist, he would say that we're just purposeless machines. Yet, he doubts Darwin's theory. So talking about the fossils, he says this: they are not, as a rule, led up to by a sequence of almost imperceptible changing forerunners, such as Darwin believed should be usual in evolution. You see, he says, nature is discontinuous. When you look at nature and you organise it into groups, and when you look at the fossil record, it doesn't match with Darwin's theory. How so? Well, the dotted lines represent where the fossils aren't. Now, Darwin knew that his theory would predict that there'd be fossils in between groups. It doesn't matter where you go, whether you go to the evolution of animals or plants or whatever it might be. So Darwin's theory is a scientific theory. But as a scientific theory, it's open to change. We don't know it all yet. It seems as if evolution happens when nobody's looking. So you look at the fossil record and you cannot see it happen in Darwinian terms. And it doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. It just means the theory seems to be lacking. Now, please don't mishear me. My point is not that evolution is wrong, but that Darwin's theory is not without scientific, atheistic detractors. If somebody comes to you and says, evolution is a fact, well, there's other atheists out there saying, well, we haven't proven it yet. That's evolution. What is evolutionism? Evolutionism is an ideology which is based on evolution. It's a combination of evolution and the belief that science can tell us everything about anything that matters. So these are quotes from Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene. So what is love? Well, it often turns out that acts of apparent altruism are really selfishness in disguise. So love is actually selfishness. What are people? We are survival machines, but we do not just mean people. It embraces all animals, plants, bacteria, and viruses. Family relationships. We can see that parental care is just a special case of kin altruism. In other words, we're only generous to one another because of our genetic relatedness. Or adultery. We must expect that there will normally be some evolutionary pressure on males to invest a little bit less in each child and to try and have more children by different wives. Adoption is the misfiring of the maternal instinct. Mothers, I'm treating a mother as a machine programmed to do everything in its power to propagate copies of the genes which reside inside it. Now, it is possible to say, well, some of these mechanisms may be real. But remember what Dawkins is saying. He's saying that this is the only explanation. Science is the only explanation. This is the sum total. There are no higher levels that we might apply to these relationships. But he goes on and proposes the idea of memes. A meme is the mental equivalent of a gene. It's the way that ideas replicate themselves. What does that mean? It has no scientific basis whatsoever. Hasn't been proven. Some psychologists have taken it on board. Consider the idea of God. We do not know how it arose in the meme pool. Probably it arose many times by independent mutation. Or those of you like music, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is in fact a meme. It's a call sign. Hell, the idea of hell is self-perpetuating because of its deep psychological impact. Thought, what we're doing now is actually different memes, mental viruses, trying to inhabit us. This is where Dawkins goes. So he's taking away any freedom of thought. Love is just selfishness. The beauty we see in nature is just means by which genes are propagated. And so he can say this: I'm attacking God, all gods. Now, ask yourself the question, can a scientist say that? Is that what science can say? But it's easy to confuse the two, isn't it? Evolution and science and the ideology of evolutionism. See, evolution can be scientific, but often it's a faith. It's a belief that people have to explain the whole of their existence. Ah, but people may say, what about all the ugly things? You know, isn't it the case that religion just is a comfort blanket? I mean, if reality is like this, then why not just accept what it is? This is the digger wasp. What it does is it lays an egg inside its host, and there's chemicals that it injects to paralyze the larva. And then it's eaten from the inside out by the parasitic larva while it's still alive. And somebody might say, well, at least Dawkins' approach sees nature for what it is, cruel, unfeeling, unjust. If that's reality, well, then you've just got to be heroic and just face up to what reality is. It's bleak, it's unjust, it's amoral. Don't turn to the comfort blanket of religion. I mean, when you turn on the TV and you see the nature programs, you know, there's the sort of evolutionary dialogue going on. This is reality. Well, it may be the case that some religions and even some churches try to present a comfort blanket and miss out reality. It may be a challenge to some of us who are Christians. The Bible is totally realistic. It acknowledges this reality of nature. See, Dawkins might say something like this. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt and other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, and you won't find any justice. There is no good, no evil, no purpose, no design, but blind, pitiless indifference. He says that's the reality when you look out on the natural world. But unfortunately, he's never heard the God of the Bible presented, I don't think. Because Ecclesiastes says a very similar thing, doesn't it? As for men, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. See, it makes the same observation of nature. And boy, does that come into human experience in the tragedies of history. But the Bible makes entirely the opposite conclusion. See, when Solomon sees the meaninglessness of nature, when he sees what nature is really like, and sees that often people are treated like animals and slaughtered in their millions, that doesn't make him say, oh, okay, we're just animals, it's all meaningless, there's no purpose, there's no design, and just throw up his hands and give up. No. What is the conclusion that the God of the Bible reveals to us? Well, that there will be a judgment day. Justice will be done. We gasp at the potential that we're just animals and that there is no justice and there is no purpose. He says, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. We don't see the natural world and think it's all okay. We don't see human history and think everything's fine. And throw our hands up and say, oh, it's just meaningless. When we see injustice, we gasp at it. And when you look at the way nature is, you gasp at its cruelty at times. And the God of the Bible is realistic. He presents through what is revealed in the Bible, I would say, reality. Evolutionism really denies beauty and awe and transcendence. It says that all we have is ugliness and meaninglessness, purposelessness. But I personally believe that this is an escape from God. I think we experience the beauty. We gasp at the beauty around us. And we gasp at this world's fractured nature. The God of the Bible, in my view, and obviously in many of our views here, is the real God. What we see in the Bible chimes with what we experience in reality. Nature fits with the plan and purpose of the God of the Bible. Because at the centre of the plan and purpose of the God of the Bible is to send Jesus and to have all his fullness in Jesus and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. In other words, the plan and purpose of the God of the Bible seems to match what we see in nature. He brings beauty out of ugliness, justice out of injustice, truth out of deceit, good out of evil, forgiveness out of condemnation, life out of death. And so for me, and I hope for many of us here, that makes him the only true God worthy of worship. He's the only true God we all, in fact, experience. Well, thank you for listening. I hope that's provoked some questions, whatever position we're coming from. Just a couple of questions to provoke further thought and reflection, and then I think we're having questions. Mike, are you taking over at this stage? Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, John. As John said, a couple of questions up on the screen there just for us to ponder. So a little bit of time to do that, to get sort of clear. What is the one thing you're struck by, the one question you want to ask? And after a few minutes, chance to ask a question from the floor, raise your hand. If you'd like to do that, we'll come running with the microphone. If you'd rather not raise your hand, on the little post-it notes around the place, write your question and we'll send someone round with a cap. And we'll put the questions in a hat. If you just rather ask your question via the hat. People sometimes say, you know, are we allowed to, is this silence? Are we allowed to talk to one another in these moments? Well, not exam conditions. Of course we're allowed to talk to one another, but we live in such hectic worlds, it's not a bad thing to take a little bit of quiet to reflect on some of these big questions. So we're going to do that for a little bit and then make sure there's time for unhurried questions to John. Okay. There's the red cap going round at the back there for anyone who wants to put a question in. And I think we'll pause now and do continue those discussions over tea. But has anyone got a question they would like to ask from the floor? Also, there are these questions in the hat. So who's got a question they'd like to ask from the floor?
Is it right for Christians to to dismiss science when science is sometimes used as answers to some of God's miracles? Should, for example, the parting of the Red Sea, mm-hmm. there's some scientific excuses for it. And if there's suitable evidence, should we be accepting it as God working through science as opposed to scientists trying to disprove God?
I guess I just question whether we can use science to investigate something that's historical. Now, sure, we can find out how wind operates and might blow seas and how it might pile up seas, etc. But we fundamentally can't go back in time with science and find out exactly what happened. There may have been aspects which were natural in a sense, but certainly I think when you go to the pages of the Old Testament, the claim is for something miraculous, something outside of the laws of nature, so to speak. So I think, I'm not sure we can investigate it scientifically. I think it's a historical question.
A couple of questions in the hat here covering the same sort of topic is how can we reconcile Genesis 1 with the scientific evidence for evolution? And were you suggesting that a belief in evolution is compatible with Christianity? And if so, how is that compatible with the biblical view that death came into the world through sin?
Do I have to do those questions together? I guess they are linked. Just to let you know where I'm coming from, I do think there's aspects of evolution which are compatible with biblical Christianity. Personally, I believe that Adam and Eve were created as in Genesis 2. I believe that there was historical fall. I think the scriptures are clear on that. But as to Genesis 1, I'm not sure. And I know Christians differ on this. But I think there is a compatibility between Genesis 1 and evolution. Time probably doesn't permit me to go into all the details of why I think that. And I know Christians differ on this. But I think always I've got in my mind We've got to be clear that if we hold to the scriptures, that the Bible being the revelation of God perfect, that's a different thing to saying that our interpretation of those same scriptures is the perfect interpretation. And I think if you look at the history of the debate between interpretations of Genesis 1, 2 and following and developments in science, sometimes Christians have clung on to a particular interpretation which has then proven to be false. For example, before Darwin came along, there was the claim that the kinds of Genesis 1 were species and therefore species could not change. But we can now observe speciation taking place before our eyes. Therefore, if you adhere to a particular interpretation of Genesis and sort of import into it scientific terminology, I'm not sure that's why Genesis 1 was written.
What about the question about death? The Bible teaches that death enters the world through sin, through humanity walking away from the God of life. How would that fit with evolution?
Yeah. Again, the question is of at what point did death come into humanity? Clearly, the Bible is clear that death came to humanity as a result of sin. I'm not sure we can be categoric about where death elsewhere was before and after the fall. Obviously, plants had to die for food. So death was pre-fall in many senses. Did any animal eat another animal before the entry of sin into the world? Did no fish eat worms? Or did no worms eat small single-celled animals? Where are we drawing the line? Is the early chapters of Genesis, is that its main concern? Can we get answers from the early chapters of Genesis because it was written for that purpose? Or is Genesis written for a different purpose? I would say my own conviction is that there is some death before the fall, that death is written to a certain extent into the way that biology works. You've got, obviously, plants being eaten and, obviously, other things being eaten. I guess one of the questions is, when does carnivory begin? I don't personally interpret the early chapters of Genesis saying that it happened after the Noahic flood, but I know people will differ on that.
Yeah, thank you. I think it was Augustine who was, even then, who was concerned that we didn't read Genesis in a way that was just foolish. We need to be wise in the way we handle it. Any other questions from the floor? I've got one more in the hat, but has anyone got one from the floor to ask? Julian.
Thanks, John. Do you think science tends to agnosticism in this sense, that scientific conclusions appear to have a degree of certainty and security which conclusions about love or beauty or relationships don't have? I mean, I might think somebody loves me and it sort of fits, but after a while, maybe they don't. And so if you're thinking scientifically all the time, you tend to expect a certain degree of security and certainty about your conclusions, and we look around the rest of the world and we just don't get that. So is it perhaps natural for a scientist psychologically to be agnostic about God, or perhaps not?
I guess that is a possibility. I guess it depends for that individual scientist how much they're prepared to acknowledge that others in the community, and even ways in which they may not psychologically be predisposed towards certain types of knowledge, are nevertheless real. So it would be quite arrogant, wouldn't it, for a scientist to say, this is the way I'm wired, this is the way that I know about the world around me, and it is pretty much the only way, and not to hear what others have to say, who may be more intuitive, for example, and may sense and experience the world in a different way. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yes, for those of us who are more rationally wired, there may be a level of certainty, but if you look at rationality, whether it sort of can hold together and be self-consistent, it can't be. Therefore, being a bit self-critical about how we approach rational explanations. So, an example, well, God either does or doesn't exist, whatever our conception of God is. So it's fairly irrational to say, I don't know if he clearly either does or doesn't know. Doesn't exist, sorry. So rationality has its limitations.
Come back.
Is that...
Any other questions from the floor?
Yeah. Hi, thank you very much. Can I make a book recommendation? I'm just in the middle of reading one at the moment by Tim Keller. It's called A Reason for God. And he takes a very logical, making sense kind of approach to all the questions, some of the ones you've been tackling, and other questions that those who don't believe might have. That's all I want to say.
Thank you.
The reason for God. Any other questions from the floor? You're going to put their hand up. Just Jack's got one here. Go. Oh, okay. Here's one.
Sorry.
No, you're just waving. You're pointing to Jack, right?
Thanks very much. You argue there from God's existence from beauty, so the God of the Gasp. Do you think that there's an argument, do you think there's a fair argument to say a God, to argue for God by definition? So by that I mean rational scientific thought can only ever investigate the world. So imagine the universe is a black box. Science can only ever, by its own definition, investigate that which exists within inside the black box. Now, if God is the creator of all things, he made the box. So if he doesn't want to be found out, he doesn't have to be. So almost from definition, you can say science cannot, prove that God exists, because it just doesn't have the tools. Do you think that's a fair argument? Do you think that has legs to it?
I guess what I'm saying is that science, by its definition of method, cannot come to a knowledge of God if God is outside the box. But I guess there's also the possibility, and this is not to say that science can argue for God, but there can be a complementarity between the scientific endeavour, i.e. before we start, scientists believe that the universe is a rational place. It has order, it has structure, that it has built within it mind, if you like. Ask yourself the question, how do we know if we're an evolved ape that the way that our brains work and are wired can key into not just an observation of the world, but can discover the mathematics behind how it works? And why is it that our minds are wired in such a way that we can understand exactly the way that the universe works? And that's how science arose, really, in a Christian society, believing that within the black box, so to speak, there is structure which hints strongly at an intelligence beyond it. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Thanks.
I think that's always my question to those who prize rationalism above all else, is how they make sense of rationalism within their own view, of the world, why they prize thought in a world in which thought is no more than chemical reactions, but more than that is whose definition of what is rational are we going to work with? So there's always a kind of subjectivity even in the so-called rational, isn't there? Final thing here, anyone got one from the floor? Last one from the floor? Going. Casey's smiling, but not asking questions, just smiling in a friendly way. It's really a statement here, but I think it's a statement that it'd just be good for you to sort of illuminate. I think it was what you were saying, and maybe whoever wrote this hasn't quite got it, but maybe we all need to just land on this. It says, is it not possible to gasp with awe at the beauty and gasp with anger at injustice?
Yes, and that I'm saying both. And that if we're gasping at beauty with these emotions of the desire to worship, and we're gasping at injustice, both point to something outside the way things are in terms of how we perceive them if there isn't a God.
Yeah. So both the gasps both we gasps. Can't make sense of within the worldview of scientism.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, John.